From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and it is primary day in a number of states. We're going to check in on a couple of them in a moment.
We're also keeping an eye on the Paul Manafort trial, President Trump's former campaign chair facing his former partner, Rick Gates, for the second day. Gates says he and Manafort hid millions of dollars from then Russia back to Ukraine to keep from paying taxes. But we start this hour in California, where the Mendocino Complex, a combination of two separate fires in Northern California, is now the largest fire in California history. And the Carr Fire in Redding, which has been burning for 2 weeks, is, according to state officials, the most destructive in the state this year. Seven people killed, more than 1,000 homes destroyed. So how are people faring? Hannah Kuiper, her husband Nico, and their year-and-a-half-old son Jackson fled their home a week ago. They lost it to the fire. They're living at her mother-in-law's. Hannah, this must still be reverberating.
Yeah, definitely. It's been about a week now, but we've had so much support. We've had time to process it as well as we could. But yeah, it was definitely quite the experience.
Yeah, well, and thankfully, your child is teething because you were up with him at, you know, 1 or 2 a.m. and you saw the alerts on your phone and you saw that there was a roadblock on your street. That gave you at least a tiny bit of time to pack. What'd you pack?
You know, in the moment, we didn't know how fast the fire was coming or when it would be here. So we grabbed what we could. We took important papers, some clothes, some of my husband's tools. But we really didn't grab that much. Like, looking back, we wish we would have grabbed more.
Yeah. What do you wish you'd grab?
You know, there's some things like my son's baby book that I couldn't find in the moment. Some pictures, things like that.
Yeah, you did get the hand-painted first Mother's Day handprint.
Yes, I did. Thank goodness.
I'm so glad. Look, you know, have you seen your home? Have you seen your neighbors' homes?
Yeah, we were able to go back to the property. Our area was hit pretty hard, so it's hard to see our homes, our neighbors' homes, friends, things like that. It's hard to see that all gone.
Yeah. Do you think, I know you're staying at your mother-in-law's and there's a lot of grandparents and, you know, your son thinks this is a big party, all his cousins are there. But do you feel in shock? What do you think your state is?
Yeah, I think we're all still in shock. I mean, it's still, like, you look outside, it's still, there's ash falling from the sky still. We haven't been able to really get back to the property more than that one time.
Yeah.
So definitely, I would say still a lot of us are in shock, yeah.
Well, and interesting, you remind us your house also had been a source of income. I mean, a house is so much to people, but you've been doing Airbnb rentals while you were finishing school to be a therapist, but you have finished, you're working again as a marriage and family therapist, so you don't need that income as much, but you forget what we lose when we lose homes, maybe even an Airbnb.
Yeah, definitely. There's, you know, we've been so blessed and supported by community members, family, strangers that we don't even know. So I appreciate all that so much. So we're not in a rough spot or anything like that. But you do, you lose a lot of things that you don't really think about, like memories and things like that.
Well, you say you're not in a rough spot. I mean, you lost your house.
Well, I mean, we're in a rough spot, and it's a terrible thing, but there's so much gratitude for, like, I can't even explain the amount of support and generosity that I've seen in this community as a whole.
What are some of the things you're seeing?
Yeah, so I had a good friend of mine set up a GoFundMe account, and the outpour from strangers, family, community has been amazing. And then just donations for my son to make sure he has clothes and toys and diapers and wipes. There's just been a lot.
Well, you know, there's been lives lost, lots of animals lost. This is an area where, you know, animals mean a lot to people. That's why they're in some of these areas so they can have their animals. And so there was a hopeful note for you that we want to mention because
yes.
A lot of people love seeing this picture. We're going to put it at hereandnow.org. A chicken and a cat huddled at a doorstep, looking as if they'd done 10 rounds with each other. The firefighters found them huddled there for safety on this porch. And this is your chicken?
Yeah, it is. And it was a pretty cool story. We didn't know that it survived when we were leaving. We didn't have room, so we just let the chickens out and just hope for the best. And then a couple days later, my neighbor sent me a message, and she said, wow, that's amazing about our neighbor's chicken or our neighbor's cat and your chicken. And I had no idea what she was talking about. And then I saw the news stories on it. And we called around the vets in Reading and we found it and we gave our address and they said, yep, that's where we found it. And we were able to pick it up and bring it to my mother-in-law's house. And it's running around with six other chickens right now.
This is Brownie, the chicken who survived the fire. We understand the firefighters actually went back to make sure the chicken and the cat were okay. You need these signs of life.
Yeah, so the firefighters, they got them in a kennel together and brought them to the vet. And it's just a heartwarming story in all of this sadness.
Yeah, of survival. Hannah Kuiper from Redding, California. Again, her home was destroyed in the car fire. Hannah, we wish you and your neighbors the very best. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
We are following a number of primaries in a number of states. Today in Kansas, Republican Governor Jeff Collier is trying to hold on to his job. But President Trump threw a wrench into those plans yesterday when he endorsed Republican Chris Kobach, Kansas's Secretary of State. Joining us now from Topeka is Jim McClain of KCUR's Kansas News Service. Hi, Jim.
Hey, hi, Jeremy. Thanks for checking in.
Well, and thanks for being here. Chris Kobach is known for his hardline views on immigration. He served on the president's controversial Election Integrity Commission, and the Republican Governors Association did not want the president to endorse him, but he did. Here's Kobach yesterday or today on Fox News talking about those critics in his own party.
Those same voices were the people who were saying President Trump should never get the nomination because there's no way he can beat Hillary Clinton. He's too outspoken in his views. It's the same argument being made against me, and I don't think it'll wash. If people are pretty excited in Kansas to do something about cutting taxes and stopping illegal immigration, which are my top two priorities.
Okay, so those are his top two priorities. The incumbent is Governor Jeff Collier. We spoke with him last year on our visit to Kansas as he was preparing to take over for Sam Brownback, the outgoing governor. Amid the state's budget crisis, here's what he had to say.
There are challenges, and we are going to deal with them, and we're going to deal with them in a really positive way. Right now, we're having lots of discussions with Kansans, but we're also discussing with the legislature, various parts of the administration, on how do we move forward. And the secret for us is how do we grow over the next few years?
Give us a sense of what's going on with this race.
Well, it's tight to begin with. Between Collier and Kobach, a couple of polls show that it's very close. A couple of others show that Kobach is up by a bit. So it's a tight race, and both are very conservative. Kobach is more flamboyant. Collier, as you just heard, more soft-spoken and quiet. And Collier is kind of the pick of the mainstream Republicans in Kansas. Kobach certainly is the darling of the Trump base.
There's also businessman Greg Orman, an independent candidate. And then, of course, there will be a Democrat running.
Yes, there'll be a Democrat. We've had the first Democratic primary for governor in more than 20 years. Democrats, as you know, can get elected governor in Kansas occasionally. Kathleen Sebelius was the last one. So there's a competitive primary on the Democratic side as well.
And what kind of factor will Orman play?
I think he'd be a big factor. He's well-funded. He's a very wealthy Johnson County, Kansas City suburbs businessman. And he ran for the U.S. Senate against Pat Roberts in 2014 as an independent and was really very close in the final weeks of that race. In the final weeks, Roberts pulled away and ended up winning by 10 points. But I think he'll be a factor.
Okay, so that's what's happening in Kansas. Jim McClain, thank you so much for joining
us.
You
bet. Thank you.
And now let's go to Michigan, a state that went for President Trump in a surprise in 2016. There are some closely watched primaries today, including for governor, to succeed Republican Governor Rick Snyder. Michigan Radio's Shayna Roth is with us from Lansing. Shayna, Democrats are trying to take back the governor's mansion from Republican control. Is that likely? And what has the campaign been like among Democrats?
It's definitely a possibility. All things are a possibility, particularly given that the Republicans have had that control for 8 years. And really what's interesting among the Democrats is this sort of question of who is the more progressive. They all say that they're true progressives. And that question of what does it mean to be a progressive has really played into their race. We have three candidates and, you know, it's going to be tight, I think, among them as far as who comes out on top.
The candidate who's been endorsed by Bernie Sanders is Abdul El-Sayed, who calls himself the most progressive candidate.
Well, he does, but then also Sri Tanadar, who has spent millions of his own dollars on the campaign, has also released ads for months now saying that he's the most progressive candidate. And then you have former state senator Gretchen Whitmer, and she's really been attacked for being a so-called establishment Democrat. But she says that she's always been a progressive, and she says that she's the only one who has an actual legislative track record of pushing a progressive agenda.
And on the Republican side, President Trump has endorsed Attorney General Bill Schuette, who is seen as the front runner against the Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly. What should we know about that race?
It's been an interesting one to watch. Trump endorsed Schuette really early on, and he is also the state attorney general who, you know, kind of the running joke around here goes that he's been running for office since he was a child. So he really has had a lot of name recognition from the start. So it's unclear how much that Trump endorsement is going to help out. And Kelly has really had to contend with being the lieutenant governor during things like the Flint water crisis, which, incidentally, Schuette is currently prosecuting some members of the governor's administration for. So that has been an interesting, you know, to sort of see those two really kind of go after each other on various issues. And then there's also two others in the race. There's State Senator Patrick Kolbeck and businessman Jim Hines.
Shana Roth of Michigan Radio. Shana, thank you.
Thank you.
And this week we're exploring borders, the dividing lines that keep people out, but today, borders that keep people in. That's the sound that enchanted Kate Bush, Paul Simon, Frank Zappa, and frankly, me. But the people behind these voices were hidden for years behind the Iron Curtain, the ideological drape around the Soviet Union and its satellite states, their brick-and-mortar symbol being the Berlin Wall that separated East and West Germany. The Bulgarian state radio and television female vocal choir was first captured on tape in the 1950s by Swiss ethnomusicologist Marcel Sellier. A reworked album, Les Mystères des Voix Bulgaires, Mystery of the Bulgarian Voices, came to the U.S. in 1987 on Nonesuch Records. It was a sensation. But the choir couldn't come until the Iron Curtain began to lift in 1988, and their concert at Lincoln Center sold out. A follow-up album won a Grammy for Best Traditional Folk Album in 1989. But the lifting of the Iron Curtain may have been this group's temporary downfall, as we're about to hear. They faded from view, then in May released a new album collaborating with beatboxer Skiller and singer Lisa Gerrard of Dead Can Dance. Let's hear more. Jim Farber is a longtime music critic. He also teaches a course at NYU and joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Welcome.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. It's always nice to find another, you know, Bulgarian state women's choir groupie.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I think a lot of people certainly from the 80s remember when the first one came out here, it sold, you know, over 500,000 copies. It was a gold album, and it made such an impression, I think, partially because this whole notion of what was first marketed as quote-unquote world music, you know, it really just began at that time between that album and Graceland, which came out around the same time. Really, those two albums were the first ones that opened up a lot of American ears and other people in the West to all these sounds from around the world. It was really the beginning of something huge.
Oh, It was amazing. And also the fact that you couldn't see them. You know, these these albums or copies of them were passed around, you know, in college dorm rooms. And it wasn't until, as we said, the Iron Curtain fell that they could come to the United States. And I remember the Lincoln Center concert where they first played. I mean, everyone, Paul Simon and everybody in music was there because they'd been waiting for years to see them.
Yeah, well, Paul Simon and a bunch of other musicians had actually first heard the choir from a 1966 recording. Frank Zappa heard it, Paul Simon heard it back then. And most importantly, I think David Crosby and Graham Nash, because they have never stopped talking about that record. If you see interviews with them today, if you see an interview like where they're on tour now, they will still mention that album as really important in influencing their harmonies, even though they use very different harmonies. But it opened up, I think, particularly David Crosby's ear. And certainly if you listen to some of David Crosby's stuff, you're not going to hear anything that sounds like the Bulgarian Choir, but you will hear very unusual harmonies. And again, this does not sound like the Bulgarian Choir, but it's interesting to see how he heard it and translated it into his own language.
This is a different way of singing. It's not the Western way from the diaphragm.
It's not. I mean, it's not typical Western bel canto singing. When you talk to Lisa Gerard, who is Australian, she said when she first heard these women and she tried to imitate them, she said, it almost broke my voice. You know, she really couldn't sing the way they were singing. It was coming from, you know, really kind of a different part of the body. I mean, different sort of harmonic structures, different ways of singing together, you know. It wasn't like a typical kind of call and response. In a way, a lot of times you'll hear the voices doing different things at the same time, so it's like there's multiple leads rather than just the typical lead and backup singer relationship that you'll hear more commonly in pop music.
And it's chest and throat and nose as opposed to deep in your diaphragm. But Kate Bush took a run at singing with them. She included several of the women on her songs. Let's listen to one. This is Rocket's Tail. It's tingly. Jim Farber, I mentioned that it was so great when the Iron Curtain fell and we could see them, but it wasn't that great for the choir.
It's an important point. They were supported, as right in the name, state TV and state radio. These women were very well known within the country. You know, I mean, they had this outlet of all the media and were supported from the 50s up until the fall of communism. And then once the communist government was collapsing, they were sort of on their own. And a lot of them had to go back to teaching and couldn't make full-time livings doing music. This is one of the problems that came after those hit records.
Well, there's an irony there because you reminded us that they were supported by the communist government, but a lot of their singing was subversive.
Well, it was, but it always had been. It wasn't new to that regime. In other words, it's common for folk musics around the world to have subversive messages. The lyric will appear to be a love song or about something that the townspeople do for a living. But it's really their messages there about power and about control. And all the people who are in with it, you know, who like get the messages and who really are the main audience for those folk musics, they get it, but the people in power don't.
Well, While funding was found recently, this new record has been released, Buchi Mish, and again with Lisa Gerard, Dead Can Dance. Let's listen to another piece, Para Satunda. So, Jim Farber, there's a beatbox there, and it isn't the original experience, but how would you describe it?
Well, you know, the man who really kind of helped put this together, the arranger and composer of a lot of these songs, Peter Dundakov, he composes all kinds of film music and electronic music in Bulgaria. He said they wanted to try to create a new kind of folk music, but they didn't want to just repeat what they had done. The original recordings were almost entirely a cappella. There's a lot more instrumentation on this. There's an instrument called a kaval, which is a flute kind of instrument, mainly from the mountains there, and a gadulka, which is a stringed instrument. As far as the beatbox goes, their feeling there, and I think they're on solid footing here, is that that happens in the mouth just the way all of these vocals are happening in the mouth. Mm. So they figure it's akin. And also hip-hop is a modern folk form.
Yeah. So there is that. We recommend people to the new release. But I would also say just go back while you're at it and get the originals. I was reading that in the 1950s, early 1950s, when the first director of Bulgaria's State Ensemble for Folk Songs and Dances was asked by the government to put together this group, that he borrowed from the impressionism of Claude Debussy and the 12-tone innovations of Arnold Schoenberg. This is complex music.
But it's also interesting that he reached out, and it also shows that the music was never, quote-unquote, pure. I don't know if any music ever really is. I mean, you know, all music is sort of a hybrid and should be. You know, it's dynamic, it changes. And even folk, which we think of as something traditional, that changes too. And I think that's one of the things that this project really wanted to highlight, that even folk music can progress.
Yeah. That's longtime music critic Jim Farber talking about Les Mystères des Voix Bulgaires, the mysterious voices of Bulgaria. Jim, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Border Crossing Bulgarian Women's Choir. Tomorrow, how borders inspire books. It's here and now. As you've no doubt heard, the opioid crisis is the deadliest drug epidemic in American history. Health workers using every strategy to save lives, inventing some new strategies along the way. And in San Francisco, overdose training is now happening in interesting places. Laura Clivens of KQED reports.
Kristen Marshall gets comfortable on a bright red pleather sofa at St. Mary's Pub, a dive bar in San Francisco's Mission District. 10 people trickle inside from the midday sun. Some wear funky glasses, some have sleeve tattoos.
You know, nobody made you be here. You just knew that this was something that was good.
Marshall places a white nasal sprayer on a table in front of her. It's Narcan, the drug that reverses opioid overdoses.
And you wanted to be prepared to look out for your customer base, and in many cases, like your direct communities that you're from.
Marshall works with the city's public health department. Her typical audience is drug users. But today, she's talking to people who work at bars, clubs, and festivals. She tells them what signs to look for if they suspect someone is overdosing on opioids, like heroin or fentanyl.
Unable to maintain consciousness, or they're going to be real hard to wake up, especially if alcohol is involved, and they're not breathing enough.
A person's body will droop. Their skin will become ashen or bluish-gray.
The first step is that 911 call. Now you're going to stimulate them awake with pain.
Like a knuckle rub to the sternum.
If they go right back out or they just are not responsive, the next thing is the Narcan. So then you're going to take this all the way up their nose. One click. That's it.
Awesome.
Cool.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, of course.
After the class, everyone gets a Narcan 2-pack to take to their next shift. This is Marshall's 10th Narcan training session for the nightlife industry. One of them was for Hush Concerts, a music production company in San Francisco. At the Hush office's creative director, Robbie Cole, points to a photo on the wall. It's of a good friend and a DJ he worked with a lot.
And you can just see, you know, how effervescent a person he was.
That friend died 3 years ago. Cole and his colleagues still don't know from what. But after Cole took the Narcan training, he began to suspect his friend died from an opioid overdose.
The signs were really all there. And had, I think, people on that site had that kind of training, they might have been able to intervene.
At most events, Cole's employees are the only sober people. Lots of patrons experiment with new substances, sometimes not knowing what's in them. That's why he had Kristen Marshall train his entire company. He hopes that someday, if needed, they can save a life.
We who are of the after-hours community, you know, who live this beautiful life that's very undersung, can actually make a difference for people.
Hush Concerts sends emergency bags to each event the company staffs. Inside, there are adapters, plugs, power cables, anything a DJ may need. There's also a first aid kit, which now includes 2 doses of Narcan. For Here and Now, I'm Laura Clivens in San Francisco.
We are also hearing that some libraries are checking out Narcan kits for the town's health officials. What is your town doing to combat this terrible opioid crisis? Let us know, hereandnow.org.
Today we're kicking off our weekly Senate Tracker series. Each week between now and the midterm elections, we're going to be checking in on a Senate race. There are 35 out of 100 Senate seats up for grabs this year. 26 of them are held by Democrats. The Senate is currently split 51 Republicans, 49 Democrats. That includes 2 independents who caucus with the Democrats. There is a closely watched race in Tennessee where Republican Congresswoman Marsha Blackburn has been endorsed by President Trump.
We are all here tonight to support the next United States Senator from the great state of Tennessee, a very, very early supporter of ours, and a really wonderful woman. She loves your state. She loves your country. She's going to win. Marsha Blackburn. Come up, Marsha, for a second. Marsha.
Blackburn will face former Democratic Governor Phil Bredesen, who released this ad.
I've said before, if President Trump proposes something good for Tennessee, I'll be with him. That's why I'm fine with his outreach to North Korea. You gotta try. But if he proposes something that hurts Tennessee, I'll oppose it. And these new tariffs will hurt us.
We'll also be checking in on the Senate race in Nevada, where Republican Dean Heller is running for re-election.
My opponent right now is breaking bread with Hanoi Jane. This is the same Hanoi Jane that said it was understandable that our military men were being tortured in Vietnam.
Hanoi Jane, the nickname for 80-year-old actress Jane Fonda, who hosted a fundraiser for Heller's Democratic opponent, Congresswoman Jackie Rosen.
We all have reasons to fix our health care system, but Republicans in Congress keep voting to repeal Obamacare instead of fixing it. They would end protection.
So stay tuned as we check in on those races. Today, we will focus on West Virginia, where most pollsters are labeling the race a toss-up between Democratic incumbent Senator Joe Manchin and Republican State Attorney General Patrick Morrissey. Joining us now is Dave Mistich, senior reporter at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Dave, good to have you back on Here and Now.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So Manchin is a Democrat in a state where President Trump won every single county in 2016. How has he been able to keep this state a toss-up?
Well, you know, Senator Manchin's attempted to align himself with President Trump as much as possible. You know, there have been plenty of differences, though. I mean, one of the things that that President Trump pointed out is that Senator Manchin voted no on the tax reform bill. That being said, you know, Senator Manchin continues to engage with the president as much as possible. He was the first Democrat to meet with Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. Mm-hmm. So he's sort of weaved back and forth with a relationship with the president, as well as sort of dealing with some of these nominations that the president has put out there as well, too.
And West Virginians know Joe Manchin. They have for a long time.
Yeah, that's exactly right. He's been around in politics here in the state for nearly 30 years. He was governor, secretary of state. And he's been around for quite some time to know the name Manchin is to live in West Virginia.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's listen to one of his ads right here.
In the Farmington No. 9 mine explosion, I lost an uncle, I lost a neighbor, I lost guys I played ball with. This is real for me. As West Virginians, we've all faced hardships, but we help each other.
Okay, so that's what he's saying in one of his ads. He is leaning on that history in West Virginia, as opposed to Patrick Morrissey, his opponent, who is actually originally from New Jersey. What do voters see in Morrissey?
Well, you know, I think people see a very conservative candidate in Patrick Morrissey, very, very, very pro-life. As a matter of fact, just launched a new committee that supports him on those issues. I think that we're also seeing a candidate that fought the Obama administration on various issues. You know, Patrick Morrissey led some litigation with attorneys general across the country, namely some work in repealing the Clean Power Plan. So you're seeing a candidate who targeted the Obama administration, who has aligned himself with a lot of conservative values, and who has also aligned himself very closely with the president.
Morrissey was also, though, a lobbyist in Washington for the pharmaceutical industry, which is interesting given that West Virginia has had more opioid-related deaths than any other state per capita, according to the CDC. Is that playing a role in this campaign?
Well, you know, I think it does. I mean, obviously, you know, the opioid problem is something that's hit so many people here. Of course, Morrissey's trying to dodge off, you know, those facts as well. So we'll see to what effect that does actually play a role. But right now it's kind of a toss up at this point, and it's hard to tell.
All right, let's listen to one of Morrissey's ads.
We'll take on Washington liberals. Keep their hands off our guns. Stop their pro-abortion agenda. I'm the conservative fighter who went for West Virginia.
So Morrissey talking there about gun rights and abortion rights. What would you say is the biggest issue in the campaign so far?
Well, you know, I think at this point it's the economy, mm-hmm. It's healthcare, of course. I think that you know, one of the things that we're seeing a lot of is a lot of talk about Manchin's vote on Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. We'll see how much that plays a role. Larger than all of that, though, I think, and this needs pointed out, is the role that failed GOP nominee Don Blankenship might play a role in this race, you know, as we move forward.
Right. And he this is the former coal executive who spent a year in jail for his role in the Upper Big Branch mine disaster, which killed 29 miners in 2010. We remember that Blankenship lost the state's Republican primary, but now he wants to run as a third party candidate.
Yeah, that's right. So he's filed to run on the Constitution Party ticket. The Secretary of State's office has rejected that filing. As Blankenship's promised, he plans to fight the state's what is known as the sore loser law in court. You know, he gathered signatures to get his filing certified. The Secretary of State's office rejected that a few weeks back. And here we are waiting at some point or another to see whether or not Blankenship takes this to court. But basically, the state law prevents someone from running and losing in a major party primary and then turning around and running as a third party candidate, one of the unrecognized parties in the state on the November ballot. So Blankenship, I think, could be an X factor there. Obviously, Manchin has no problem with him being on the ballot. Mm. That only stands to benefit him. Morrissey, on the other hand, that's a completely different story. Obviously, with Blankenship having ran in the Republican primary, it only stands to hurt Morrissey.
The most recent FEC filings show that 95% of Manchin's individual donations are coming from out of state, compared to 76% of Morrissey's, but in each case, most of the money is coming from outside of West Virginia.
Yeah, that's right. There's a lot of interest in this race here, but obviously elsewhere. The major parties, of course, are pumping a lot of money into it. And, you know, it's still, you know, we're in August, but we've yet to see this thing down the home stretch. So I think that trend of outside money coming in is something that we're going to see more and more of.
Do you expect President Trump to be spending a lot of time in West Virginia this fall campaigning for Morrissey?
So we have already seen him here in the state a few times this year, and I think that we can only expect that to be increasing. You know, the president's son, Don Jr., has been here. The president himself has been here. And, you know, speaking to crowds at the Greenbrier, which is a resort owned by Governor Jim Justice. But I think that we can expect that to only amp up as we head towards November.
Are there many polls so far? What are they saying?
Well, there's, you know, I think that we've all learned to not trust polling after 2016. But the latest polls that we've seen put Manchin with a little bit of an edge. But I think after last presidential election, that that's raised a lot of questions about the accuracy and the usefulness of some of these polls. So while I think the candidates are going to be quick to tout their own advantage from a poll, I think the public in general is a little bit skeptical of that. And certainly we are as reporters, you know, here in West Virginia.
Well, and also any poll right now may not reflect whether or not Blankenship is in the race. And if he is, that would change things a lot, too.
Absolutely.
That is Dave Misich, a senior reporter with West Virginia Public Broadcasting, looking at the Senate race in West Virginia as we kick off our Senate Tracker series. Dave, thank you.
Hey, thanks.
Facebook is drawing fresh scrutiny after the Wall Street Journal reported Facebook asked large banks to share financial information about users, things like card transactions and account balances. Facebook says the report is not true, but there's been an avalanche of unquestionable truths about Facebook and Google and Twitter that's buried Silicon Valley in PR problems. Can these companies dig themselves out? Let's go to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. And Kara Swisher is editor-at-large for Recode, also one of the New York Times' newest contributing opinion writers. Her latest piece is headlined, "The Expense of Education of Mark Zuckerberg and Silicon Valley." Kara, you write in the very first line, "I like Mark Zuckerberg, always have, but he and Facebook have been working humanity's last nerve for far too long now." What do you mean?
Yep. Yeah. Well, I think that's pretty self-explanatory, yeah. Is that you can like people and then see them doing things that are really damaging. And I've been following Facebook since its beginning. And right now it's at a critical period in its history. And it's done some things that are problematic and they have to fix.
Well, the Russians have surfaced again, according to Facebook, yep. Trying to interfere in elections. You write every week it's something and that something is never good. But that something is at the heart of how Facebook works. You know, sell stuff off people's communications. But hands off the content. That's always been how they've worked. Are they going to be able to pull out of this, change that?
Well, you know, they've made some moves yesterday. I did a podcast with Mark Zuckerberg that got a lot of attention,
yes.
A couple weeks ago because he talked about letting everybody on this platform, essentially, and he got in trouble for discussing Holocaust
even
deniers.
Holocaust
deniers.
Even Holocaust deniers.
I mean to be wrong, which yeah. I disagreed with. Yeah. But I think yesterday they all of the tech companies started to throw Alex Jones off of their platforms as being damaging and full of hate speech and things like that. But it took them long enough. So they're trying to sort of dial back. But what I think they're beginning to understand is this is not an algorithmic problem. They run media companies, essentially, even if they're new kinds of media companies. And they've got to start thinking that way in terms of what they want on their platform and what they don't.
Yeah. You spoke of conspiracy theorist Alex Jones, his InfoWars website. He of the, you know, Sandy Hook shooting did not happen,
yeah.
You know, was thrown up. Finally from those platforms. But I've spoken to Facebook defenders about that idea of, you know, you are media. You might need to have an editorial board or,
right.
You know, people. And they just absolutely refuse that notion or even, you know, any kind of regulation, even though didn't Mark Zuckerberg once say to you that he thinks of Facebook as a utility?
Yeah, that was in a good sense that they would deliver. He was contrasting himself to the sort of the sexier companies of the day, like MySpace, which has gone by the wayside, obviously, and others. I don't think he was talking about wanting to get regulated. I think he just was reliable, I think, is what he was saying. What I think, you know, what the problem is with the defenders is that Facebook is not the government. And so the government, of course, there's all kinds of First Amendment rights around government and where you're allowed to assemble and things like that. But these are companies. You know, Disney fired Roseanne for something she said. Now, that's not a violation of her First Amendment. She got to say it. She just had to pay the price. And I think that, you know, freedom of speech is critically important, but it doesn't have freedom from consequence. And so that's what Facebook and others, not just Facebook, but Twitter and Reddit and all these things, they have consequences for the decisions they're making. And they're tough consequences, and they're going to have to figure out how to deal with the consequences of what they do.
Your thoughts on the Wall Street Journal reporting that Facebook has talked to several big banks, let's see, J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, Citigroup, about getting users' data, things like
that. Well, it's accounts. A little more complex than that. Like in China right now, WeChat, there's a lot of transactions that happen on these chat platforms. And so I don't think it's unusual for them to want to give more and more features to people as they use the service because they want to lock people into them. I don't know if that's an unusual thing so much. The same thing around the stuff that they give information to phone companies. They can't work very well if they're not they don't work well on these phones. And so some of it, it all points to the idea is nobody trusts Facebook, right? I think that's really the more point. They want to expand their businesses and the services they give to their customers. And anything they do now is going to be immediately suspect because of the sieve of information that seems to have come out of it. Mm-hmm. And the fact that the platform was built for just this reason, which is sharing of data. And that brings up big questions of who gets to share it and who monitors it and who has control of it.
And how it gets out. There's another line that you had. You say that Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube have become the digital arms dealers of the modern age, weaponized social media, weaponized the First Amendment, weaponized civic discourse, and weaponized most of all politics.
Yeah, that's pretty strong.
Yeah.
What I was trying to say is I don't think they're malevolently doing so, and I don't think they meant to do it. It's just their platforms were built to do this. And these issues have been around since the beginning of time, right? This discord and things like that. But what happens on social media is it gets amplified and amplified and amplified to such a point that it allows malevolent parties to take these tools and use them in just the way they were created, which are often bad ways. And that's a lot of, you know, people come up with all kinds of metaphors like cigarette companies, this and that. I think it's more like fire. I mean, you never know if fire is going to burn your house down or it's going to warm your hearth, right? Mm-hmm. It's an old saying. And so that's what it is they haven't understood what the implications of their inventions are. And I think that's what I want them to think about. I want them to think about what the damages that could happen in real life from what they're doing.
Their Pandora's box.
I think it's a good time for them to reflect.
Look, anyone who uses kudzu in an article, I love that. it has spread like kudzu, that southern weed. Kara Swisher, editor-at-large for Recode, contributing opinion writer for The New York Times, thank you.
Thank you.
And listeners, we want your thoughts. Are they kudzu? We would love to hear from you, hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.